Welcome, welcome, welcome everyone to episode 39 of Tech Cars Machines. This is your host, Ali Tabibian, lifelong techie, longtime tech investment banker with a couple of electrical engineering degrees from Stanford, bringing you great guests and smart conversations. Please click subscribe, click like, leave a review. You know how to do it. Just do it. Thank you in advance. This episode's guest is Chris Creed. He is the Chief Investment Officer of the Department of Energy's Loan Programs Office, or the LPO for short. Chris manages a slice of a $400 billion pie from the U.S. government to fight climate change. Famously, in 2010, the LPO provided $465 million to Tesla, which proved critical to that company. 2 weeks ago, a project to develop Thacker Pass in Nevada as a very large lithium mine received $2.3 billion of support. Chris spent 23 years at Goldman Sachs as a managing director in fixed income. He gave me his background and why he loves his government job. We discussed the main rationales for LPO's involvement and the bridge-to-bankability stage at which it gets involved. We got into detail about suitable project profiles, financials, and loan terms. We finished how he started, hearing about Chris's enthusiasm for his job, his deep admiration for his team, and the importance of his work to climate change. By the way, if sustainability is your thing, we have many related episodes. They include episode 38 with GE Vernova on green energy, episode 37 with the Midwest Alliance for Clean Hydrogen, episode 33 on the largest hydrogen storage project in the world, episode 25 with hydrogen aircraft company Universal Hydrogen. We have four episodes to give you a comprehensive view of green energy in heavy-duty transportation. Episodes 27, 28, and 32 are with the heads of strategy at Daimler Trucks, formerly Mercedes, Traton, a Volkswagen affiliate, and Volvo Trucks. Episode 24 is with the head of the new power division with Cummins Engine. For now, let's go to Chris and the Loan Programs Office.
Tech, cars, machines. Subscribe here or at gtkpartners.com.
Chris, thank you for joining us today. We'd really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Great. Chris, where are you dialing in from today, so to speak?
I'm sitting in my office at the DOE headquarters here in Washington.
Great, great. And I think you split your time between New York and Washington. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. Spend many a day down here in D.C., but I live up in New York.
Excellent. Two great cities. I lived in New York City for several years myself. They're both wonderful places. Chris, tell us a little bit about the Department of Energy's Loan Programs Office, where you are the Chief Investment Officer.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extremely exciting place. I mean, this is effectively a large private, as in non-SEC registered credit business within the U.S. Department of Energy. We have an exciting vision. Our vision is a secure and clean energy economy that works for all Americans. And our mission is to be the premier public financing partner to accelerate high impact energy generation and manufacturing investments here in the United States. So how cool is that? I get to see many of our country's best and brightest entrepreneurs bring us amazing projects. I get to work with really talented and amazing people throughout government, but in particular here at the Loan Programs Office. And I get to use my background in fixed income to try to help solve one of the great crises of our time. So it's an amazing opportunity, an amazing job.
You know what? I'm going to be jealous if you answer yes. And the question is, do you actually get to go to some of these facilities and visit them occasionally?
Sometimes. I mean, we have a great team. And so my job is to help make sure that our team is doing the right thing. And so from my perspective, I want to make sure that all of our teammates get to go to these facilities. But I've been to a few.
That's always very, very exciting to see a large industrial scale project. I always really got a buzz out of it. Clearly, what you're doing has a social objective to it. One thing I want to clarify, if it's true before we head too deep into it, is it may be true that you have a social objective, but each loan or each facility needs to meet its own financial and capital recovery metrics, right? You're not making a social value judgment at the project level.
That's correct. Each of our projects needs to meet what is known as a reasonable prospect of repayment, which means that we do very intense credit diligence on all of our projects. One of the things that I'm the most proud of is the work that our deal teams do. We produce literally hundreds of pages of work, sometimes close to 1,000 pages of work, that takes months, 3 to 12 months of intense due diligence. We engage outside advisors, independent engineers, market advisors, financial advisors, obviously legal advisors, to help us do the level of diligence that needs to be done when you're talking about billion-dollar plus loans to, in many cases, emerging or soon to be commercialized industries. So it's a lot of work that we do. And that term of art, reasonable prospect of repayment, is what we're required to do by our statute. And that's on top of obviously making sure that the projects are eligible, that they meet the other requirements that the program has.
Great. And what are the funding sources for these loans? Is this part of a recurring funding that the DOE has, or are there special legislation from which you're drawing your funds?
Many of our programs were set up years ago and have some residual funding, but the bulk of the funding came from the Inflation Reduction Act. So the IRA added significant both loan authority, which is the authority to make a loan amount, as well as the credit subsidy, which you could think of as the present value of the cost of the loan, which is the amount that we budget whenever we make the loan. And so both of those authorities come from Congress, and in a very significant way, the IRA helped fund the expansion of this program.
Excellent. So, Chris, tell us, how did you get into this business, so to speak?
I'm lucky. I got two great parents. I got awesome brothers. And, you know, we moved around a lot when I was a kid. I graduated from St. John's High School in Massachusetts and ended up at Brown University, two institutions that are still quite dear to me. You know, I was lucky right out of school to get a job at Goldman Sachs. I was a mortgage fixed income person for 21 years and very much enjoyed it. Still have very good friends that I met from my years at Goldman. In 2021, had the opportunity to, and I wish I would have kept the piece of paper, literally draw a Venn diagram of what am I good at? What do I think is going to have significant growth opportunities over the next 10, 15, 20 years? And what am I going to be proud of? What am I going to want to spend my time now that I'm well into my 40s? And fixed income financing of the clean energy and green economy quickly rose to the top as an obvious thing that I should be pursuing. Through good old-fashioned elbow grease and networking, I met Jigar. And the rest, as they say, is history. I joined the Loan Programs Office summer of 2021. Almost a year ago today, actually, was asked to be the first chief investment officer of the LPO, and it's been the best job I've ever had. Talked a little bit about that at the beginning, but the ability to be in the seat at the time when you need to be, with the tools that we were given with the IRA, and being able to meaningfully contribute, man, that's special. It's not lost on me that we have an amazing responsibility, but also we have an amazing ability to do it.
Thank you for that inspiration, really. So two things for the kids who are listening, so to speak. One is intentional planning does pay off. You can write things down, put them in Venn diagrams, and then put some effort around it. You don't need to wait things to happen to you. And the other thing is there is a lot of excitement that you can derive about mapping what you want to do to what the world really needs. I'm a child of medical professionals, Chris, and I remember my father, who since passed away, he told me he was a surgeon. He said, every stitch I made was a little piece of heaven for me. Mm. And that's the kind of really commitment to a particular career, to a particular outcome of your career, that can really make a big difference for you in terms of enjoying it day to day.
I'm inspired by that too. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm straight out of a Frank Capra movie, but right across the street is the National Mall, you know, to my right is the Capitol building, to the left is the White House. Like, it's cool. It matters what we're doing. It's fun.
Let me ask you something that I'm sure will be on the minds of a lot of our listeners who are generally senior level, but still have a technical background, frequently are in the financial world. We normally think of people who live on Wall Street as sort of a laissez-faire people in terms of economic organization. Did you have a view before you joined the government in terms of what role the government should have in sort of picking projects, picking winners and losers, or subsidizing a particular activity?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know that I had a view prior to getting here. I don't know that I thought much about it. Now that I am here, I understand the important role that LPO plays, that Congress gave LPO to play. And it's probably worth spending a little bit of time talking about what our role is, what it's supposed to be, and what it can be. In some of our programs, the metaphor that we use is we provide a bridge to bankability for emerging clean energy and decarbonization technologies that are on one side of this metaphorical river, and on the other side is commercial liftoff and broad commercialization. And we help provide that bridge, whether it's debt funding of first commercial or second commercialization projects, or whether it's de-risking through scale projects that need to be, you know, larger than would otherwise be bankable by the financial markets. Crossing that sort of valley of death, or crossing that bridge to bankability, is an important role that we play. It's not the only role we play. We also are enabling the expansion of domestic manufacturing and supply chains to support this cleaner and stronger energy economy. In fact, depending on when this podcast drops, very recently, we announced a new lithium transaction in Nevada. It'll be another of many battery supply chain and battery chemistry deals that we have announced over the course of the past couple of years. We have the first active anode assembly facility here in the United States that we helped fund. We just announced a conditional commitment to Thacker Pass Lithium Americas to try to do CAM and lithium. We've had battery recycling deals announced. Of course, we've done two large battery assemblers that sell to OEMs, that captives for OEMs, the Ultium, which is a joint venture between LG and General Motors, mm-hmm. and Blue Oval SK, which is a JV between Ford and SK. And if you go back in our history, of course, we were a debt provider to Tesla. So that broad EV battery chemistry and supply chain, that's super important as well. And the other thing we take very seriously is we need to make this clean energy transformation affordable for all Americans, workers, consumers, communities, all stand to benefit from this important economic opportunity that we have. And so we take seriously our role there. We, you know, all of our projects now require community benefits plans to be thoughtful about the impact that our projects have on their communities. It's a cool and broad mandate.
If I could maybe provide a little bit of background for those of our listeners who saw the Oppenheimer movie. The Manhattan Project was commissioned by the Atomic Energy Commission, which is the predecessor of the Department of Energy. And so the DOE essentially and its predecessors have been around a long time. And the Western Power Administration manages Hoover Dam, which is a big sort of tourist spot for those of us, you know, who take our kids around on a road trip over the summer. So the DOE is really responsible for a lot of things that we have, including Tesla itself and the loan that it benefited from. So I think what you're describing is really a continuation of a degree of involvement, which it's had for what, going on 80 years now almost.
Yeah. It makes sense that the Loan Programs Office is part of that continuum of support. The way I think of it is, if you were to think of technology readiness level as a scale, mm-hmm. the national labs support the early stage technical development of important projects. Our friends in the Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations, they help bring about demonstration facilities and sort of mid-stage TRL 6, 5, 6, 7. And our job in that scale is to help with commercialization through debt financing, very late stage TRL 7, 8, and 9. That, I think, is a very helpful way of thinking about where we fit into the broad DOE mandate.
I think, for example, the Office of Technology Demonstration, I think, I'm forgetting the exact name, that's the group that's funding the hydrogen hubs.
Exactly. The Office of Clean Energy Demonstrations, or OCED, O-C-E-D, among their many projects, the hydrogen hubs is one of theirs.
Exactly. And the prior episode before yours is with the CIO of that institution. So we had Midwest Alliance for Clean Hydrogen speaking to us last time. You sort of defined the bridge to bankability as one way that you look at a qualifying project. There are some other interesting phrases that are part of the DOE's own description of the Loan Programs Office. So maybe we start with the word emerging, for example. How emerging can it be from a technical or scale perspective?
It's a really helpful question, because I think that for the Loan Programs Office, we do take many types of risks, credit risks and technology risks, but we don't really take will it work risks. We know it will work. It works in the lab. It works in their demonstration facility. Let's say we're making widgets. We know that they can make a widget at the lab at Brown University. We know that they can make a widget at their demonstration facility, wherever you want, outside of Pittsburgh. Our risk is when we build the large widget factory in Wichita, Kansas, will we build it at the price that we are modeling it or less? Can we run the facility at the price that we are modeling it or less? Can we get the feedstock and raw materials for our widgets at the price that we are assuming or less? And can we sell our widgets for a price that we're assuming or more? I don't want to oversimplify finance to your audience especially, but those are the primary categories of risks that we're willing to take. Consequently, we might take some merchant risk. We might take some feedstock risk. We might take some EPC risk. We might take some O&M risk. And the question that I am often asked is, well, how many of all of those risks can you take? Because, you know, I want to know. And the answer is, it really depends. It depends on the project. It depends on the amount of equity that an investor is bringing. Will they guarantee the debt on the parent side? There's a lot of components that go to that. But hopefully that gives you a sense of the kinds of risks that we're taking. In terms of the kinds of technology, it is actually program specific. So we often talk about the Loan Programs Office as this one large $400 billion lending fund that sits within the Department of Energy. And that's true, but it is made up of a number of specific programs. One of those programs is the Title 17 Clean Energy Financing Program. That, which I will colloquially call 1703 after the section of the code, that requires innovative projects. So they can only have been deployed, you know, sort of zero, one, maybe two times before in the United States. And it's really to help sort of first of a kind projects get across that bridge to bankability. The 1706 or the Energy Infrastructure Reinvestment Program has different eligibility requirements. It is to repurpose, retool, replace energy infrastructure in the United States and help us make sure that we are putting in the investment on our CapEx investments into our infrastructure that we need to put in. That does not have an innovation requirement because some infrastructure just isn't innovative. And so as we think about the program, questions like that really need to be, in my opinion, program specific. And here's where one of the things that Secretary Granholm and Jigar have done when they came in to run the DOE and the Loan Programs Office was to stand up a outreach and business development group that is now 40, 50 large to help applicants understand that component. Hey, come talk to us. We'll open up our guidance documents. We'll talk to you. You can have a person that you can whiteboard with to figure out what program is right for your project, what are the requirements of that program, and what do you need to do to apply for that program.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because I think most people would assume that, as they often do with government programs, that they need to go hire their own external consultants as step one to show them how to do that. How would one get in contact with that group? What is the approach to the Loan Programs Office?
Well, the easy answer is please go onto our website. If you Google Loan Programs Office, Department of Energy, we have a robust website where we have contact information. We also have information about our portfolio. We put our news press releases out. We have blog posts where we talk about relevant, interesting topics to energy finance. So it's well worth checking out.
Okay, great. One thing that's striking is how much the analysis and the approach and the diligence that you perform to extend these facilities mimics really what, you know, certainly I'm used to, and I'm sure you're used to in the private sector. Does that sound accurate?
It definitely does. When I think about what we do here, non-SEC registered, private, bespoke, bilateral financing arrangements. Gosh, that sounds like exactly what a lot of private credit funds do on Wall Street. And so that's what we do. We make loans, U.S. government loans to projects, or in some of our programs, we can guarantee third-party loans to energy projects. And in order for us to get comfortable that we are fulfilling our requirements, including the analysis of the reasonable prospect of repayment, mm-hmm. we need to do real credit underwriting. So it's all of the things that you would assume that a private credit fund would be doing, we're doing. We have a robust application process where we ask our applicants to give us a detailed business plan, a feed study, an analysis of greenhouse gas emissions reductions. We want a pretty detailed understanding of what it is, what is the project that they would like financing. And then we diligence that project. We hire an independent engineer to make sure that we understand that the construction costs and the O&M costs and the range and variance of those costs under reasonable and stressed scenarios are things that we understand. We are, by design, a risk-taking organization. And because of that, we need to understand the risks that we are taking, and we need to take them eyes wide open. So using the sort of S&P rating, our average at time of origination ratings of the loans that we lend are single B plus, double B minus. We're emphatically a high yield speculative grade lender. Mm-hmm. As such, we're going to have a default rate. We're going to have a loss rate. Right now, we're very proud that our, you know, some default rate is just a little bit under 7 and our loss rate is in the low 3s. And relative to that ex ante underwritten rating, pretty strong. And so I am very proud of the work that the team does. And to your point, the level of diligence that we do is rather intense.
This might be a good time to segue into the T's and C's of your loans. You know, typically when you think about a bank loan, you think of ratios, of coverage ratios, of various metrics, coupon rates, other terms, all the whiz bang stuff that you're far more expert on than I am. Tell us about those, the terms and conditions, the horizons, the returns you look for.
We have some things that are set to us by statute. So we must make sure that our loans don't extend past the lesser of 30 years or 90% of the useful life of the project being financed. In reality, most of our loans are a little bit short of that, and they're in that sort of 7 to 14 year range. We often utilize cash sweeps to amortize down the loan. We oftentimes have amortization features such that the actual final maturity is not the same as the average life or the duration. Our interest rate is between Treasuries plus 0 basis points and Treasuries plus 200 basis points. It is somewhat dependent on our program and somewhat dependent on the credit risk of the project that we're lending against. But in either case, these are fairly attractive interest rates for borrowers. Our advance rate is also capped by statute at 80% of eligible costs, which is not necessarily a term that a lot of our industry friends use. So if you want to think of it in LTV space, mm-hmm. probably in the low 60s. But again, fairly wide range. We certainly have some that are more like 75 or 80, and we have others that are more like 50. But that should, you know, 60, 65 is a pretty good number to have in your head. And in terms of, I'm constantly asked, what's the DSCR at your P50 that you're tracking? And the answer is, it depends. We have a number of different metrics, and DSCR is certainly one of them. We look at, just like any private lender or just like any lender would look at, we look at what are the outcomes in various stress scenarios? What are the independent variables that I need to model and I need to stress? What are reasonable stress cases for those, whether it be offtake price, feedstock price, O&M costs, construction overruns, whatever those things might be. I need to model all that up. I need to have a number of different scenarios that we present. And the culmination of all of that analysis sort of gets at, you know, how much am I willing to lend for what term? What are the terms of the cash sweeps? What are the CPs to various advances? How should I stage the advances? All of those are the discussions that we have bilaterally with applicants.
Great. Thank you for that description. The production and consumption tax credits that are available in the law, is that typically what your projects are also taking advantage of? And I'm assuming that's really something that goes into the calculations of the receiver of this facility and not really something you directly.
We certainly, we certainly look at the ITC and PTC income that is being received, whether it's received directly to our project, whether it's monetized by our project and sold either through tax equity or transferability, or whether it's something that this project itself might not benefit from, but because it is selling a domestic content intermediate supply component to somebody who has those tax credits, what does that mean in terms of the offtake price? Or if the tax credits go to a sponsor or a parent, what does that mean, and what then level of parent or sponsor support are we expecting? So we definitely look at the ITCs and PTCs and put that into our analysis.
Gotcha. Thank you. Any other metrics that we need to talk about?
Invariably, each project has its own interesting variables. And so sometimes we need to look at supply chain logistics. Other times we need to look at availability of skilled labor. Still other times we need to look at the long lead times for NEPA review or other permitting reviews. So each project, you know, this is part of the reason why, you know, I'm so proud of the men and women that I work with, because they are both very financially savvy as well as, you know, mission focused, because we're trying to do all of these things and do it for projects that are themselves snowflakes. The metaphor I often use is that part of my job is to help Henry Fordify the production of snowflakes, because each of these loans is different.
Community benefits and social equity. That's one of the things that was really striking in the last podcast episode we did around the hydrogen hubs and how much of a real sincere effort and requirement it is for that impact to be calculated in what those programs were. And I understand that you also take community benefits into account. How do you think about those benefits? How do you quantify them? And what are the objectives that you're trying to achieve?
As I think about the mandate or the mission that we have, you know, a clean energy economy that works for all Americans, we have a responsibility to be thoughtful about the impact that our projects have on communities. So whether that's engagement with the community for environmental reviews, whether that's engagement to our communities for the availability of skilled labor, whether that's, you know, working with our communities for sort of more blocking and tackling things, all of our projects reduce greenhouse gases. Many of our projects also consume electricity or energy in order to do that. And so, you know, how are they connecting with the grid, and what are they doing to, you know, to try to, you know, minimize the impact that they would have on electricity usage? So like, these are the sort of things that we're trying to think about. I also want to touch on sort of labor as an example for 2 seconds, because I often am in the position of speaking to people like you and your conferences and whatever. And I like to make the point that community benefits and credit underwriting are not two completely separate things. In many cases, we need to talk about them together, right? The unemployment rate is 3.9, and the availability of skilled labor is a risk, a credit risk to many of our projects. And so the community benefits plan to engage local colleges, to engage workforce hiring,
training,
job training, and whatever, is a mitigant to the risk that one of our lines of our widget factory in Wichita, Kansas won't be able to run because our project couldn't hire enough people. And so from our standpoint, these sort of go together and help complement each other.
That's a nice note maybe to transition into our final segment here is, how do you see the future? And to create that future, what help would you like, just generally speaking, and in your position at the DOE, from large companies, growth companies, other sources of capital like equity and debt capital?
It's a great question. Large companies and equity capital have an opportunity to be sponsors for a lot of our projects. We have materials on our blog about investing with the LPO to talk very much about this. Mm-hmm. But the idea is our program has an intermediate public step called a conditional commitment. And when we offer a conditional commitment to an applicant, we make that public. It's the point in time actually where we put the obligation on the government's balance sheet. It is not the point in time where the final financing documents are executed and signed, but it is the term sheet stage. And between that term sheet stage, conditional commitment, and financial close, many of our applicants look to raise equity because we're debt lenders. We lend, what did I say, 65% LTV. They got to go find 35% of not senior debt.
Right.
Many times that's equity. It's sometimes a combination of equity and subordinate debt. In either case, they're out looking for some capital, and it's an opportunity for equity capital and large companies with either a venture arm or an M&AI. They can be a equity investor in some of our projects. And so we don't play matchmaker, but we do think it's our responsibility to let the broad financial system understand our process such that if they want to look at our program and see what are those emerging and growing energy companies that are seeking LPO financing, they know what does a conditional commitment mean, where are they in their process such that they can engage those companies if they wanted to. Debt capital, we are often in deals with other lenders. Rarely where the other lenders are also senior with us, because our rates tend to be pretty good. And to be blunt, in many cases, the risks that we are taking specifically because the private sector doesn't have an appetite for the risks. But they could be mezzanine debt. They could be existing debt. They could be inventory debt or some other related debt. And so we want to work with those investors as well. So they understand what we're doing. They understand, you know, what are the things that we need in an intercreditor agreement or whatever it might be. And so it's important for us to have a good relationship with the other debt investors as well. And of course, the growth companies, many of which are applicants for us. And so we are looking at, it's something like 205 or just a little bit north of 200 applicants that are actively going through our process right now for more than $250 billion of loans. And so obviously they're the American entrepreneurial companies that are working to catalyze and commercialize important technologies that will reduce greenhouse gases, help bring about a significant economic growth through the green economy, and hire and utilize great American workers. They're the reason we're here. The line that Jigar often uses and Undersecretary Crane uses is that we are private sector led, but government enabled. And so we're reliant on these growth companies coming to us and saying, hey, we have this great idea. We want to build this widget factory. Can you help us?
Is there a particular segment that you'd like to hear more from, or are you getting a pretty good sample from the whole spectrum?
I will answer it by saying we think it's important to tell the public what's going on with our program. So on a monthly basis, we release our monthly application activity report, where we break out by technology sector the kinds of applications that we're receiving. So whether it be, you know, renewables deployment, whether it be hydrogen or storage or nuclear or whatever it might be, we break that out so that our stakeholders can see the kinds of projects that are applying for loans from us. You know, we have programs that are out there, and we view our job as to make sure that the growth companies understand how to apply to our program. And we spend our outreach and business development time going to, whether it's conferences or podcasts such as yours or whatever it might be, to let them know about our program and the public-private partnership that we offer. But less so saying, oh, you know what I would really like is, you know, this. I will say that broad DOE has started what is known as the liftoff reports, the pathways to commercial liftoff. So if you go to liftoff.energy.gov, you can see we, and LPO is part of the group of offices that heavily contribute to these thought pieces. And there you can see what are the insights that we're getting from our interactions with the private sector, and what are the possible paths for commercial liftoff for various different technology sectors. And they're all really amazing reads.
Great. We'll put a link to that in our show notes, a couple of the resources you mentioned, because it'll be helpful for our listeners and hopefully helpful for you as well. Chris, I mean, you're clearly making a big difference in your seat. When you step back and look at the scale of the challenge and the scale of what you're doing, how do those two compare?
The mandate that we got from Congress, especially with the IRA, was awe-inspiring. They gave us a big mandate, and we are trying to live up to that mandate. I've said this a number of times, but I genuinely mean it. I am unbelievably proud and thoroughly enjoy working with the high quality caliber of teammate that I get to work with here at LPO, and the mission forward way that they're taking the mandate that we got from Congress and saying, hey, we have to execute on this is very cool. The reason Congress gave us the mandate and the reason that I and a lot of my teammates are here is because the climate crisis is extremely acute. Mm-hmm. The opportunity for economic growth and to help with American competitiveness is strong. And the mission and vision that we have are inspiring. So which one is more important? I don't know, but they're both extremely important.
Thank you, Chris. Is there anything else that you would like to cover? You've been very kind and answered all my questions.
No, I just, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and via you, your listener base, and, you know, encourage the dialogue with the financial institutions, with those growth companies. I look forward to the conversations that this podcast catalyzes and appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
It's been our pleasure, and I know our viewers will be a lot smarter for having listened through this podcast.
I don't know about that, but it certainly was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Tech, cars, machines. Subscribe here or at gtkpartners.com.
If sustainability is your thing, we have many related episodes. They include episode 38 with GE Vernova on green energy, episode 37 with the Midwest Alliance for Clean Hydrogen, episode 33 on the largest hydrogen storage project in the world, episode 25 with hydrogen aircraft company Universal Hydrogen. We have 4 episodes to give you a comprehensive view of green energy in heavy-duty transportation. Episodes 27, 28, and 32 are with the heads of strategy at Daimler Trucks, formerly Mercedes, Traton, a Volkswagen affiliate, and Volvo Trucks. Episode 24 is with the head of the new power division with Cummins Engine.